It's a happy Thursday evening. You're tuned to Radio Sai Asia Stream. And that means it's time for Radio Sai Answering Booth. From our studios in Prashanthi Nilayam, joining you live, this is Prem, your friend from Team Radio Sai, and welcome you, dear listeners, to this week's episode. This is a show where listeners send me questions pertaining to practical spirituality and we try to answer them based on Swami's message, isn't it? As I always say on the show, it is very important that we pause every now and then and before we make decisions, act or speak, ask ourselves, is this the right thing to do? Is this the best way to do this? Or more importantly, is this what Swami would expect of me? Whether we have control over our actions and words is the next question. And all sadhana we do enables us to gain that control. And for many of us, it may still be difficult to act according to what we believe is right or what we have come to understand is the right action. But the more we ask these questions, the more we fit in a filter between our impulses and our expressions, both verbal and physical. And eventually, ever so slowly, we will see the difference in the way we are. It calls for the three P's that Swami would say is the most essential for any success, all the more for success in the spiritual quest. The three P's being purity, perseverance, and patience. Purity of purpose and intent, perseverance in our efforts to correct ourselves and not giving up, and the patience to see ourselves through till the end of the journey. Swami has given us all the answers. It is now for us to constantly ask the questions. Praying to Swami that He blesses us in this endeavor of ours, let's offer our most humble pranams at Swami's lotus feet. Let's then head to the week's program. We have today a few questions sent to us by a listener. They are wonderful questions, but intense nonetheless. So I'm not too sure we'll be able to answer all of them in this one particular episode. More so because the questions are based on a few basic and, I would say, general concepts, which I would like to talk about in a fair amount of detail. And you know how I like to talk about in detail on many, many occasions. And that would make the answer more general and hopefully beneficial to many more of us, I feel. And that's why I'm planning to do that. But we'll see how it goes. And anyway, we still have a few minutes before we need to make that decision, isn't it? For now, it is the time for the quote of the week. The quote is that I wish to read for you today is from one of the most popular spiritual writers of the 21st century, the author of the book, The Power of Now, Eckhart Tolle. It's a simple one-liner, nevertheless, it's very profound, and this is how it goes. I quote, "The primary cause of unhappiness is never the situation, but your thought about it." End of quote. How simple and true that is. It's actually common sense, we know it, but yet we find it difficult to use this information to our benefit. As Swami would explain, let's say there are some rumors floating around about you. People are talking behind your back, all kinds of nonsense about you, which are based on some lies that someone has just set off. And this has been going on for a few weeks, let's say, and eventually you get to know about it. The moment you know about it, you become sad, angry, feel betrayed, pained, etc., etc., whatever be the emotions. Now the situation has been around for a few weeks. The only thing that has changed is you have got to know about it. And the moment you come to know, the mind starts processing that information and then the emotions involved start kicking in. Then how can we say that the unhappiness or pain is because of the situation? On the other hand, let's say the rumor is about someone else whom you don't know personally or whom you're not very fond of or attached to. The same situation. The rumor has been about for a few weeks and then it also reaches you. Will the mind start thinking the same way? No, it won't, because it is an information that is not bothered about. It is you're detached from it, isn't it? So the situation as such never causes pain. The thinking is what causes it. And why do we start thinking at all? When we are attached to the info in some way, that is, the information is about me or someone else who is close to me or something I am associated with. So the root cause for any emotion is the feeling mine, me, my friend, my family, my country, my religion, my community. The list can go on. That is why in spirituality, the attitude of mindness or mamakaram is seen as the root cause of all misery. And instead of dealing with every other situation that comes up, can we deal with this fundamental issue itself and do away with all misery? Of course, this also involves a process. It's not becoming completely cold to all relationships and associations, but gaining the wisdom that all such relationships, associations and attachments are fleeting and are momentary. They are like friends that we make during a train journey. Each has their own journey to make. Each gets off at their station in life, and our journey must go on till our station comes. When this wisdom is born in us, we will be kind and gentle with everyone, but not get attached. When we don't get attached, the mind does not react the same way to situations, does not react with the same passion. And when the mind does not react, the situations are mere happenings. And in our role, and if our role calls for a certain action, we will be able to do that diligently and more effectively. Before we head to the question of the week, dear listeners, permit me to read that quote by Eckhart Tolle one more time. I quote, "The primary cause for unhappiness is never the situation, but your thought about it." Well, let's then head to this week's question. As I said, the question is from one of our regular listeners. She's actually sent us three questions, and I'm very grateful that she sent it to us in her own voice. So I'll be playing out the question. As I said, I'm not too sure I'll be able to handle all of those questions this week, but nevertheless, we'll listen to all the three questions and we'll see how it goes.
Sarang Brother Prem, first and foremost, I would like to express my appreciation to the Radio Sai team for the wonderful work that is being done, which allows devotees like me, who have not had any personal interactions with Swami, to learn about His teachings and apply it in our daily lives for our own self-transformation. From the Radio Sai discussions and insights that have been aired, it has helped me tremendously in my spiritual growth. Kudos to all of you. Today, I have three questions for the Radio Sai Answering Booth segment. My first question pertains to the decisions I make in my capacity as a government official. In my country, we have very strict rules and code of conduct for all government officials, and this includes not receiving any sort of benefits, monetary or in kind, from anyone. I follow this very strictly and also guide my staff to adhere to this regulation. The question arises for contracted staff, for example cleaners, who are not part of the government service. The incident in question is that these cleaners had been collecting recyclable stuff which belongs to my organization to be sold for monetary benefit and to be shared amongst all of them. The monetary benefit is not much. It is just probably a few $100s, which will not make any difference to my organization. However, we do have a recycling program in place. My dilemma is that these cleaners are very aged. Most of them are in their 70s, earning very little, but have been serving the organization dutifully even in times of crisis. They are likely to have taken on this job in their old age because of their family situation. Am I to apply the same rules that I apply to my staff, or should I exercise flexibility and show compassion and allow them to benefit from the monetary gain? Often in my course of duty, when I'm caught up in making decisions, which I'm not sure whether they align with Swami's teachings, what do I do, especially when the decisions are to be made immediately and I have no time to ruminate over them? This is my second question. In the various sharings that I've heard in Radio Sai, often mention is made about the bhava or feeling when we remember the Lord. How can I express this feeling when I do Namasmarana or Bhajan so that it does not become a mechanical routine? My third question is on the theory of creation. I've always grappled with understanding the creation theory. I'm an SSC teacher myself. How can I explain the theory of creation to children and youths in a simple manner? Thank you.
That's the question sent to us by Ms. Vijaya Ganesh. And as I said, there are three questions there, not one question. And three of them are in completely three different topics altogether. And as I said, the first question is a very, very important one. I think it's a situation that most of us face. And I'm thinking that that's going to take most of this week or all of this week's show, because it's an important thing. And as I said, it's based on a concept, I think, which needs a little more elaboration. And it would be good for all of us to dwell on that a little bit. So maybe I think that's what we'll be doing. We're going to take that first question alone. It's a very interesting situation that was being mentioned. I don't know if all of you were able to gather that. I think to put it briefly, there are certain rules that apply to the permanent staff members in the organization which Ms. Vijaya is heading. And you're not supposed to gain any monetary benefit out of the objects that are being used in the course of the work. But there are some contract laborers who are typically very poor and elderly people who sometimes benefit out of some of these things which are not very useful to the organization again, though there's a recycling program, so they kind of sell these items. I'm not sure of the details, and they make money out of it. It's no big deal because they benefit out of it. That few hundred dollars which they make and they distribute among themselves is a big sum for them, but it's not a big thing for the organization. But if you strictly adhere to the rules and apply the rules even to those people, then you're not supposed to be allowing them to do that. So is it all right flexing the rules a bit to allow some people to benefit like this, whom you know that, you know, they're not doing anything wrong, or this is not technically something which is illegal or not supposed to be done? So what do you do in such situations? So I think it's more a question about how strictly should we really stick to rules, right? That's the question it often comes down to. When we always have rules in whatever we do, be it in our workplace or be it in our course of life in the society, there are always rules and regulations. There's always this debate of should we be following the spirit of the rule or the law, or should we be sticking to the law in spirit and letter, right? That's a debate which is ubiquitous. I think everybody kind of comes to this confusion at some point in time. And sometimes the nature in which we follow these rules and regulations is almost cultural. You can see a pattern in different cities, in different countries. You know, they often say this. If you see the way traffic rules are adhered to in various cities, you'll know how this pattern plays out. In some places, they will always stop at a light, even if the road is absolutely empty, even if it's middle of the night. You'll always see people very, very strictly adhering to the traffic rules. In some places they follow, but you know, then they take it easy during certain times when you know that by not following the rule, you're not going to harm anybody else, you're not going to inconvenience anybody else. You come to our Indian cities, then we follow only the spirit of the law. What's the spirit of the law? Well, don't bang into anyone, don't harm anybody. So the drivers are so confident of their skills that they will probably not follow any rules at all, but they will ensure that they don't harm or bump into anyone, right? So the way we look at rules is completely different, and sometimes it's even a cultural way in which we respond to rules and regulations, right? And we see this in many, many spheres of life, right? The confidence that one has in one's own abilities and one's own judgment sometimes tends one to disregard rules to a certain extent, right? When you know that I'm sure of what I'm doing and I'm sure of my intention, so why do I need to adhere to these rules? Especially, you know, when youngsters say that I know my limits, I don't need regulations, or, you know, when we want to do good but do not have the patience to follow the due process through which it has to be done. We always say, why these rules, when what we are doing is after all the right thing to do, or what we are doing is going to benefit the others, what we're doing is what is good. We always have this question that confidence in our own intentions, in our own judgment, sometimes makes us disregard rules. And it is also about that, you know, general discussion about means versus ends. The goodness or the purity of the ends, does that justify the means, or is the means as important as the ends? I think that's a different debate altogether, where some people believe that as long as the ends are noble, we don't need to bother about the means. That's a very general theme. We won't go into that today because it's a different topic altogether, and we have done an entire satsang on that a couple of years ago. But that's a very general theme. All I'm saying is this question also touches upon that particular dilemma or debate too. I'm still not telling that we must follow the rules. I think from what I've said, it's not that I'm disregarding this this attitude that rules do not need to be followed so strictly as long as your intentions are good. I'm not telling that you should follow the rules. I'm not telling you in reply to the question that you asked that apply the rules as they are to the contract workers and don't let them take away the stuff. I just wish to take this opportunity, as I said, to talk about this a little more so that, you know, we don't draw simplistic conclusions. I often say this, maybe I think that's the nature of some of our approach to life. Sometimes we take very simple decisions. I've said this many times on the program. We look at situations in a very casual manner. Sometimes it's probably important to look at it a little more deeply for us to get a better understanding of it. And eventually, I think the second part of the first question that was asked is, when you don't have time to react, when you don't have time to really ponder over what you do, I think that is a different situation altogether. But when we have the time to ponder about, I think it's very important to go into some of these details, look at it from various angles. And I think that's what we'll try to do in the next few minutes. So why do we need rules and regulations? What does Swami say about them? Of course, I'm not going to be comprehensive in this, but just a few points regarding why do we need rules and regulations. I have spoken about this a couple of times before, but I want to make three points which are a little different from probably what I would have said before. Point number one, like I said in the example of the traffic rules, I can say that I am in control over the car and I know what is expected of me. Right. So when I'm confident about my own skills, I would say that I don't need to follow the rules to the last letter. The problem with this kind of approach is the smooth functioning of a system such as this, where each one is confident about their own abilities and they say that we can, flout the rules. The smooth functioning of such a system starts becoming more and more dependent on an individual's ability. Right. We often want a system that is independent of an individual's judgment, because we want a system where different kind of people would come, engage with that system, work with that system, or use that system, right? And then there is a total harmony in that. Such a system should not be based on the acumen of the individuals involved. So the system should be independent of the individual's nature and their confidence and their abilities, right? That's one of the main reasons why we have rules and systems in place, where anybody can come in. They could be, you know, a very good, for instance, the example of the traffic rules. Somebody could be a very, very good driver. Somebody could be a learner. All of them will be able to follow these rules and not harm anybody else and not harm themselves, right? That's one of the things that we kind of look for when we are creating systems or when we are creating rules and regulations, to make it independent of the individuals involved. The second point is, rules always bring a sense of dependability. That's what I would often think of as. Let's say that I'm climbing up and down a stairway. Imagine if the steps are of uneven height. I think we've all encountered such stairways sometime in our life, and it becomes so difficult to walk up and walk down that, right? When they are even, there is a certain amount of dependability on those steps. You know what you're looking for. I mean, you know what you can expect, right? There's a certain height. So you get what you expect for, and it makes that negotiation of the example when I'm giving that of stairways, it makes the negotiation of a path like that very easy, right? If this is with inanimate objects, this is so even with the road. When I'm driving on the road, I don't want potholes in the road. I should be able to encounter what I expect from the road. I expect that if there is a deep curve in the road, there's a sign which says that, you know, look ahead, there's going to be a sharp right turn. Or if the road is getting narrower, there's a sign which says that the road ahead is narrower. So you kind of are able to, in a sense, predict what is coming, and that actually makes the journey easier, right? So if this is what it is when it comes to inanimate objects, imagine when it is interaction with other people that we go through in our life. We need a certain amount of dependability or predictability to carry out any kind of transaction for that matter, be it in relationships, in our works, plays, or in public spaces. In fact, this is what is the basis of what we refer to as dharma, or doing one's duty. Anybody, you know, in any role that you play, be it the role of a mother, the role of a son, the role of a teacher. A certain number of things are expected when you play that role. So as a student, when I'm going to a teacher, I expect the teacher to interact with me in a certain way. And if she or he is sticking to the duties of a teacher, if he or she is performing the dharma correctly, then that person becomes predictable to a nature and dependable. Dependable is more important, is the more important keyword there. So that interaction becomes more smooth when I know what to expect of this person, and that person does what is expected of him, or that person does what is expected of her, right? So this is one more important thing why we have rules, be it in systems or be it in the roles that we play in our life or the roles that we play in our workplace, all of that, what we refer to as dharma, what we refer to as duty, all of this falls under this category of creating a system or an environment of dependability and predictability to a certain extent. The third point why rules and regulations are important is, as individuals, sometimes we can't see the entire picture. The larger picture is sometimes not comprehensible for an individual going through, in a particular situation. Many times, I think rules are created by some people who can get a wider perspective of things, right? Or the rules would have evolved over a certain period of time. They would have seen, what is the need that needs to be addressed, and accordingly, the rules would have been modified. So every time when we go into a certain situation and there are rules governing that, be it in traffic, be it in our workplace, be it in our interaction with others, when there are rules governing a certain activity, we should understand that the rule is not being created ad hoc. It has been created probably intelligently. I know sometimes some rules have been made mindlessly. I'm not denying that. But most often, rules have been made not by one individual who sees only from his or her point of view, but has been created by a certain set of individuals who see a larger picture of that particular scenario, right? So that is what makes some of these rules very, very important. And when we look at a rule and say that, oh, this rule is meaningless, I think sometimes we are only looking at it from our point of view. We are only looking at it from the individual's point of view. And we miss out the larger picture, which has led to that particular rule being created, right? So this is something which Swami would say. Any kind of rule that has been created in the society is sometimes more or less made for everybody and made with an attitude of equality towards everybody, right? That's why some of these rules are very important. So these are three points why Swami would often say that, rules are important. Why rules are important, even if you are in a spiritual journey, the rules that we accept, be it in an organization like a spiritual organization or any other corporate organization, the reason why we accept it is the three points. As I said, these are not comprehensive, but I think will be useful for us to look at the question at hand. One, as I said, it is the system is not dependent on the individual's ability or judgment or goodness. The second one is it creates a certain sense of predictability, of dependability, and that's what the idea of dharma is all about. We'll speak about it a little more as we go ahead in the program. And the third thing is, as I said, sometimes as individuals, we don't see the entire picture from our point of view. Many times the rules have been created by a set of people who see a larger picture. And that's the speciality of democracy that we all celebrate today. Rather than having one person who has all authority in the name of a king, you have representative politics where you have intellectuals from different walks of life coming together and thinking that this is would be a good rule to have, or this could be a good law to have. So the third point is, generally, rules and regulations in society are made by a larger and a few people rather than just one individual. Of course, as I said, this is not comprehensive, but this probably will help us understand the question at hand. Apart from this, of course, there are many other points that I've made earlier. It promotes self-control. When you adhere to rules and then you go ahead and achieve what you want to achieve, you gain better control over your own self. That's one more point. I'm not mentioning that as part of the three points that I've mentioned above. this is one of the, these are some of the reasons why Swami would always emphasize on rules and following discipline, right? Because it promotes general well-being, right? When we can live in a society abiding by some of these rules and regulations, and we still can achieve and be useful, then I think our life is disciplined and will help us even in the spiritual path. Because that's the idea of dharma itself, right? The reason why Swami gives so much emphasis for this idea of dharma, of doing your duty and adhering to what is expected of you in society. You are dependable and predictable, and when it comes to dharma, predictable in the good sense, right? People should feel that this person will do the right thing at any given time. Predictable in that sense. I mean, even if you have a bad boss who's going to shout at you for every at a drop of a hat, I think he becomes predictable, but not predictable in that sense. Predictable in the sense that you know that this person will do the right thing. Or, you know, I can interact with this person guessing what this person's response will be, that this response will be righteous, right? That dependability is what is referred to as dharma. And that's what I would like to talk about for the next few minutes in the course of this program. This concept of dharma is very, very important. The word itself is very important and, you know, it has got many, many meanings to that. But before that, when we are talking about following rules and regulations, when we talk about going into a community, going into a gathering of individuals and following certain set patterns of understandings between individuals, that this is how we will go about achieving something or doing something, right? Rules and regulations are nothing but that. Swami uses a term for this, and we've heard Swami say this many times. Swami would say Sangha Niti, right? Sangha Niti is very, very important, is what Swami would say. The meaning of the word Sangha in this is a congregation of individuals. Sangha means just an association of individuals, right? It could be a country, it could be a community, it could be an institution, an organization, any of that. When individuals come together and form one unit, it's referred to as Sangha. And Niti means the laws and rules that govern that congregation. As I said, when individuals come together and say that this is how we will go about doing these things, these are the restrictions that we place on ourselves, and this is lawful and this is unlawful, this is legally accepted, this is illegal. All of these restrictions that we place on ourselves, Swami says, this is what is Sangha Niti. And Swami would say that we must follow the rules of any congregation that we are part of. If we do not agree with the rules of that particular congregation, if we strongly feel that it is wrong or bad, then that Sangha becomes bad company, right? What Swami would refer to as Dussangha. And if it is Dussangha, if it is bad, it is a bad company to be in, then you run away from that, you move away from that. But if you are in a Sangha, if you are benefiting in any way in a society, because whenever we are in society, this is another point that Swami would make, that you gain a lot of benefit from society. Whatever you are, if you're a businessman, if you're a worker, if you're an employee, all of your life you draw benefits from being in the society, and that is one of the ways you show respect to the society which sustains you, is to follow that Sangha Niti or adhere to the rules and regulations of that particular congregation or association that you're being part of, right? So that is why Swami would say that we must follow the rules of any of the congregations that we are part of. But most often, the congregation or the association, like the organization that you're talking about, you know, we're talking about a government institution or an NGO or a private institution. Most often, an association or congregation of individuals such as this will be neutral in their approach to everything, right? When they put rules and regulations, the idea would be that nobody should have undue benefit. Everybody should be able to gain what is rightfully due to them. They should be able to gain that through working in this particular organization, right? Most often, the rules of any association or congregation such as this will be neutral. And that is why it is important to respect some of these rules. In such a case, it is very beneficial not only for us, but we will also be benefiting those around when we follow the rules of a sangha like this, or that is what we refer to as sanghaniti. So is it important that we follow sanghaniti at all times, and is it something that you cannot compromise at all, that at all times the sanghaniti should be followed and to the spirit, to the last word? Because as the question itself suggested, you know, yes, there is a rule. Yes, the rule has to be adhered to. But it doesn't appear like this rule need not necessarily be applied in this particular situation, though it may be expected of the officer to do that, right? There are a lot of people who will go into a situation like this and use the rules that are there for their own benefits, right? Or people will operate within the rules and benefit themselves unduly, right? This is again something which we see very often. How often do we come across these cases, especially when you're talking about corporate frauds, right? If you look at the way they do it, you know, unless and until later it becomes a big issue, for a long time they're actually operating within the rules and within the laws of that land and will be making undue advantage of that. And that is why Swami says that when you go into a particular community, yes, we need to follow the sanghaniti, but sometimes purely just following the rules and regulations, we still can be benefiting unduly, right? You could make use or misuse the rules and laws that are in place and benefit yourself unduly through that process. So in that case, is it enough if you just follow sanghaniti and say that, you know, I am following the rules and laws to the last word, so I'm good to go? It's not necessarily like that. And that's why Swami says the sanghaniti should eventually be built upon the idea of papa bhiti, or the fear of sin. What I'm doing may be legal. What I'm doing may be something which I cannot be pulled up for and say that I'm wrong. But if my intuition says that what I'm doing is wrong, or what I feel that this is morally unacceptable, or in our case, as Swami's devotees, we are sticking to the rule, but we feel that, you know, probably if Swami would guide me, Swami would ask me to do it differently. I think that's what is inspired the question itself, right? When you sit there as a person who is sensitized by Swami's message, and whenever we are sensitized with Swami, even love for Swami, automatically we are more compassionate. I'm going to come to that part in a bit. So we don't look at the rules as only as they are, but we also look beyond that. And we definitely don't make use of the rules to benefit ourselves. For those who go into a system and purely look at what benefit they can get playing within the rules, I think what Swami says is the next step which is important is papa bhiti, or fear of sin. You don't merely stick to the rules, but you also look at the idea of what is sin. And sin is very, very simply described as hurting someone to benefit yourself, right? So that is an attitude which guides you apart from whatever the rules and regulations are there in place. So sanghaniti is important, but where sanghaniti is not covering the ground, you look at papa bhiti, or what you understand as not harming others for your own benefit, right? So yes, we must follow the rules, but I think the fear of sin should be a compass that makes us review even the rules that we are following, especially like in the situation that we have just heard. If we are in a position to change the rules or influence the rules, I think this is a very important thing, the compass of sanghaniti. One of the classic examples that I heard was one of my classmates was saying that he went abroad to pursue his higher education, and he happened to share a room with a boy from Bhutan. And it was very interesting to meet this particular Bhutanese boy, because, you know, he represented their country in the manner that he was very, very fond of his king. He was literally idol worshipping his king, and in his altar there would be a picture of the Bhutanese king. That's how much they loved the Bhutanese king. And this particular boy was telling how the king of Bhutan, even though he was the supreme leader, even though he had absolute powers over the people and over the government, he was very, very seriously trying to introduce democracy into the country. And much to the dislike of all the people did not want democracy. They said, no, we have a good ruler, why don't you rule? But he said, no, I don't think that is the right option. we should try to bring in democracy, because you were saying that this is how the world is progressing. At some point, these ideas will come into the country, or at some point you will have a leader who probably is not as ideal as he should be, and then there will be problems. So he was saying that even though I have the authority to have complete control over the country, I myself am reviewing my powers, because I think that is what will benefit the people, right? I think that is what is the idea of righteousness even when in power. Yes, the rules don't bind me. Yes, I'm doing things in such a manner that I'm good to go with all the rules. But still, if I can influence the rules, even if it means letting go of some of my own control, if it is going to benefit the whole association, if it's going to benefit the others in the society, I think I'll go forward to that. And this will happen only if you are not strictly sticking to Sanghaniti or the rules and regulations of society, but you're also being guided by Papabhiti, right? The fear of sin, or what is the right thing to do. And it's not merely Papabhiti, because Papabhiti is sometimes like a negative stimuli, right? Something bad that will happen to you, or most often it is about the fear of karmic consequences that stops us from doing something which is wrong, right? That's why Swami goes on to say the ultimate foundation of even Sanghaniti and Papabhiti must be Deva Preeti, or love for God, right? That is what should be guiding our actions and our decisions at most times. And Swami would say that love for God comes with all of these qualities, such as compassion and empathy and sensitivity and so on. That's why I said the moment you start turning to God, the moment you start developing, we start developing love for God, automatically we become sensitive to others' needs. And when we become sensitive to others' needs, I think we will be in a better position to look at rules and really review if these rules are necessarily applicable to this particular situation or to these particular people, like the question that you ask. So let these qualities guide our adherence to the rules themselves. Yes, rules have to be followed, like what I said, for the benefit of all, because they are, you know, they are made with larger perspective in mind and all of that that I said. But if we are sure that by bending those rules, we are selflessly benefiting a few underprivileged people, I think we should. There's nothing wrong in that, as I can say. But when we do that, I think, can we keep in mind the few points that I mentioned about the larger picture, about rules? Sometimes we may benefit a few people in the short run, but it might be spoiling them, right? I mean, a typical example of that is parents tend to spoil children with too much leniency. They might think that, oh, my child, after all, you know, the child is crying, or the child is in pain, or the child is troubled, let me be a little more lenient. The Swami would say that in that case, you're actually spoiling the child. It's not compassion, or it is not empathy in that sense. So when we look beyond just what is before our eyes, beyond the immediate benefit to those around us, and see the larger picture, I think even our compassion in that situation may become more structured and well-defined. And I think that's very, very important, right? So we may graduate from this meanness and selfishness of twisting or breaking rules for our short-term benefits. I think that's the worst kind, where people go, they disregard rules, and they disregard them for their own benefits, right? They cheat, or they do illegal things, and they benefit through the thing, and they do it because there are immediate benefits to get, right? They overlook, as Swami would say, they overlook the consequences of bad actions such as that. They overlook the conscience which keeps prompting them that this is not the right thing to do. And they do it because there is some immediate benefit to get. I think most of us have graduated from that. We don't break rules for our own benefits, but we may still get stuck in the state where we are ready to break the rules if somebody else is benefiting, right? But even that could become bad, because if we are only looking at the immediate benefit of the people involved, we may be compromising the overall good that rules and regulations can bring in a situation like that. So that's why, though in general, I think selfishness is a good guide to direct our actions, direct our righteousness, it is not always so. I think it's important to look beyond that too. I think towards the end of the program, which is in a few minutes from now, I'll speak about that that particular important way of looking at decisions that we make beyond the idea of even selfishness and selflessness. As I always say, I'm in no position to make that decision for you with regard to the question of whether you should allow these people to make that money, or you should strictly follow the rules. Yes, it does seem that there is no problem in you stretching the rules for them and taking the responsibility for that. But just keep an eye for all of these points, that will your leniency eventually lead to a little degradation of the system itself? If that is so, can you bring in some checks and balances to avoid that? Or one of the things I can think of is, you know, if you are saying that these are things that can be recyclable, but you're letting them take it off, it may not be wrong, but will it eventually lead to some of these things being discarded much before their time has actually come? Sometimes it might happen like that because they benefit by selling it and they would rather make the organization buy things more often so that they can make more money. I'm not saying that they are like that. There are fallouts like this. Do you have ways of looking at it? You know, can you be hands-on, not just taking a decision and saying that, okay, I've been compassionate, I've let them have it, but even looking at it from, as I said, a system has to be independent of individuals. Today you might do that, but tomorrow if another person comes in your place, do you have a plan by which what you have started off out of your compassion and sympathy and sensitivity does not get misused later? I think that is, these are some of the things that I thought probably you can think of before you make that decision. So before I speak about another general explanation, which I said I will speak, I'll dwell a little on this point of taking responsibility for the action that you're going to take, whatever it is. I think we sometimes think that what I did was right and what I did was noble, so everybody around must understand it and they should not obstruct me or they should not blame me for taking this decision, because it's a good decision that I've taken. It's a noble decision that I've taken, right? Last week I was quoting the example of Saint Ramdas from Bhadrachalam, right? His story is very, very interesting. Those of you who are not aware of it, probably I'll give it to you in a nutshell. The story goes that he's actually a tahsildar under a Muslim ruler and he's also a great devotee of Rama. And during his tours around the land that he is in charge of, he comes across this particular village where they have this idol of Rama, and there's an elderly lady who is directed to this particular idol through her dream, in which Rama comes and tells the time in this particular place. So it's a very special idol. They build a small thatched temple for that idol and they're worshipping it. So Ramdas, who was a great devotee of Rama, he goes there and he sees this and he says that, oh God, my Rama has come so miraculously. He has made his appearance in this particular place, but there is no proper temple for him. So what does he do? He uses the tax money that he has collected and he ends up building a beautiful temple for Lord Rama. And he says that Rama is the king of all kings. All wealth, after all, belongs to him anyway. And even otherwise, the tax money is meant to fulfill the needs of the people, and I see that the people need a temple here. So he builds the temple, he takes the law into his hands, he does not inform the king, and he feels that this is the right thing to do. And eventually the king comes to know of it, he captures him, and the story goes that he is tortured, and during the process of him being tortured, he cries out to Rama, he writes these many, many songs in praise of Rama, in accusing Rama of not taking care of him, and all of those. It's a beautiful story of a devotee nonetheless. But a few times when Swami is speaking about this particular devotee or this particular episode, Swami would say that, but what he did was actually wrong, right? It was not his money to spend. He eventually, I mean, looking at it, Swami would say that he actually betrayed the trust that his king had on him. So he had to undergo the punishment that he had to. Of course, the torture part and the pain that he had to undergo is also karmic. It's a larger story altogether. But Swami would say that though what you did was noble, though what you did was driven by your conscience, in that situation, probably what you did was wrong. It was not your money to spend. It was not your it was not your responsibility to take law into your hands. And Swami would say that, see, that is what happened. And I think only Swami can say that, and Swami can point out, even at somebody whom we are looking at as a great saint, and Swami says that this is why he did something which was wrong. And another beautiful incident that I recall is, there was once this drama that was staged in Swami's presence of, there is this particular employee in a company, he's given a suitcase of cash and he's told to go for a particular transaction. He's got to go and book one particular, he's supposed to make a payment for something. So when he's going to make this payment, On the way, he finds that there's an old man who is crying and he needs some money immediately for his son who is admitted in the hospital and a surgery has to be performed immediately. So this boy is stuck up. He's got money in his hand, but there's this dying boy. So what does he do? He goes and he pays the money in the bank and he saves this kid. And later he comes back, he loses his job, and you know, he argues with the boss saying that, you know, at that moment I thought this was the right thing to do. The payment could have always been made later, but the boy had to be saved then and there. Right? So that was the drama which was staged. And I mean, as we all know, all of these dramas are actually written, and at every stage Swami is involved. No plot is actually not what Swami has himself approved or himself written and directed, right? So this was the play, and eventually he becomes a very noble person, and you know, he's a devotee of Swami, and that's how the whole story goes. The day before the convocation drama, Swami was sitting and probably seeing the last or the second last rehearsal of this entire drama. And at the end of it, Swami calls this particular boy who is the protagonist in the drama, and Swami asks him, "But what you did was wrong, isn't it? How could you take the money that didn't belong to you, it belonged to the company where you're working in, how could you use it for charity? That money did not belong to you." And everybody in that gathering were a little shocked, because this was just the day before the drama, and Swami was raising a fundamental question like this, and Swami was saying that, "No, I don't agree with the plot. What that boy did was wrong." The beautiful point I'm trying to make that Swami made at that point, and I'd like to bring that to the notice of all of you, is it's not that the plot of the drama was changed, because it was Swami's plot nevertheless. But Swami was saying that you did something wrong. Even though it was noble, it was against the rule at that particular situation, and the consequence of you losing the job was because you did something unlawful. Eventually, the good act that you did comes and saves you, right? So that is consequence of good karma. That's a different point altogether. But at that point, when you're doing something wrong, you will face the consequences. And when you take responsibility even for a good action that you do, you are accepting the consequences of that action too, even if it is painful, or even if it is unacceptable to you. And that's why I said, sometimes we get into this idea that, you know, after all, what I've done is right. After all, what I've done is good. Why people around are not appreciating me, or why people are obstructing me? And yes, I have transgressed the rules. Yes, I've not regarded the regulations. But what I did was right eventually. Yes, the argument that you did what was right is accepted, but you take responsibility that you've taken rules into your hands, and you're ready for standing up for yourself if and when there is a need for that. So that is one thing I think you should keep in your mind. If you have the ability to bend the rules a bit, take responsibility for that. If at all you're pulled up, you know, be ready to explain that, you know, this is what I thought. And we don't lose much, but they gain much more if we let them have it. And in a way, you're actually earning their goodwill. You're earning their faithfulness towards the organization. If you're able to explain this, I think there's one thing we need to keep in our mind. Even when we are doing the right thing, if we are flouting the rules, we should be ready to face the consequences. But if we are confident that what we did was the right thing, Swami says that, you know, that inner satisfaction will take you through that the situation too. You'll not be bothered about others criticizing you or others disagreeing with you. The last point that I want to make, the last section, I'll wind up in a few minutes from now. This general question of, you know, how to take the most righteous or the most dharmic decision in a situation, when we are in a situation, there are a couple of dilemmas in front of us and a couple of options in front of us, and we are stuck in a dilemma as to which option is the right one. One of the things that people often say is, you know, the most selfless act at that particular point is the most dharmic. I generally disagree with that, because that's, as I said in the beginning of the answer, we tend to take very simplistic decisions when we do that. And if you look at it, as I always quote, Arjuna was doing that mistake. He said, "I don't want the army. I mean, I don't want the kingdom. I don't want victory. I don't want any wealth and thing. I'll become a sannyasi. I'll go away." He was actually being very, very selfless. But Krishna was saying that, no, what you're doing is adharma. So always selflessness is not a way of looking at, does not make a decision dharmic. Yes, I think deeply if we look at it, in a sense, selflessness is what is the basis of any dharmic action. But superficially, it's not about just we giving away what is our due. And one of the ways, one of these very beautiful explanations that I came across about dharma or dharmic decisions is a verse in the Manusmriti. Manusmriti is supposed to be an authority when it comes to what are the rules and regulations, the nitis and nyayas, as they say, the laws that govern social living, be it a husband, a wife, a child, a teacher, a ruler, a citizen. What are the rules and regulations that each one has to follow? A Brahmin, a Kshatriya, each one of them, right? This is supposed to be one of the authorities in what one needs to do at different times. You know, it goes into extreme detail as to when you can lie and when you're all right to, you know, harm another person. Very, very intricate in its explanations of dharma, right? And there is this one particular verse in it which says that there are two ways of looking at this verse. Either it speaks of a person who has these qualities are truly dharmic, or when we make a decision, if we can see that we are satisfying these 10 conditions, then what we take as a decision is more likely to be the righteous decision, right? So this Manusmriti verse actually speaks of 10 lakshanas or features of dharma or a person who follows dharma. And this is how the verse goes. It says, Dhriti kshama damosteyam shaucha mindriya nigraha dhi vidya satyamakrodo dashakam dharma lakshanam, right? And the 10 qualities that are being referred to are dhriti, kshama, dama, asteyam, shaucha, indriya nigraha, dhi, vidya, satyam, and akrodha. I'll give you the meanings of each one of those. I'm not going to leave it there, but I'll try to group these qualities and explain. I think that will help us understand them better. Saucha and Satyam. Saucha means cleanliness and Satyam, as we all know, means truthfulness. These are two similar qualities that are very much in our control, right? What we are, how we are, the external purity and internal purity, or when we talk about truthfulness, right? Being truthful in our interactions with others, or being truthful to our own selves, right? Be truthful as to why we are choosing one particular decision over the other. Am I eyeing some benefit and pretending that I'm doing it for some other reason, or I'm pretending that this is a dharmic option that I'm taking, whereas I'm having some ulterior motive in mind? So being truthful to oneself and being truthful in our external interaction with people. Similarly, shaucha means cleanliness or purity, where we are talking about internal purity and external purity, all the qualities of purity that we talk of. Comes into play in this. So Saucha and Satyam are two qualities. Two other qualities that are spoken about in that verse is Dhriti and Kshama. Dhriti is firmness or being steadfast, or it also means being patient, right? When we do the right thing, we cannot always expect favorable results immediately after we do what has to be done. At such times, I think we must be prepared to be patient and continue to do what is right, right? Even when the results are not seen or are not immediate in their occurrence. And similarly, kshama is forbearance or forgiveness. And this is a very, very important point that, you know, why does forgiveness feature in when we're talking about dharma? If, as I said, dharma is always about the overall benefit of the people, right? We're looking at the whole society benefiting, and that's what the idea of dharma is. Dharma is always about what will sustain the society. That's the essential meaning of the word dharma. I think dharayate iti dharma or something Swami would say, where that which sustains is dharma. So dharma is that which benefits the entire society, right? So if the overall welfare can be established and the dharma can be reinstated by forgiving the other person involved, I think one must forgive. So the first option should always be forgiveness. And that's why kshama becomes a very, very important quality. And these two qualities of dhriti and kshama, Swami says that when we develop these, according to the Manusmriti, when we develop these, there are more chances that we will take the most dharmic decision when we are faced with a thing. And I'm not going into that detail. Dhriti is, as I said, the ability to be patient to see the results. And sometimes when you're doing the right thing, the immediate result is not going to be beneficial. Are we ready to still go ahead and continue to do the next right thing after that? Or are we going to say that, oh, I did the right thing, I'm not getting the results that I'm supposed to get, so what's the point in doing the right thing? So these two qualities of dhriti and shama, the ability to be patient to see the results and the ability to forgive the other person, if that is an option that will work, these two are very important. Then comes these three qualities. As you would have noticed, it's not in the order in which I read out, but I'm just grouping them for better understanding. Dama, Indriya Nigraha, and Akrodha. And all of these qualities, these three qualities, pertain to being in control of oneself. Dama is self-restraint. Indriya Nigraha is sense control. And Akrodha is not being angry. So all these suggest that the most righteous action cannot be possible if one is not in control of one's emotions and oneself. So one cannot act rightly when one is angry, or when one is propelled by sensual cravings, or when one is under the influence of any strong emotion like envy, hatred, revenge, pain, or fear, right? So that is why a certain amount of control over our own self, be it the sense control or our mind control or control over our anger and our emotions, you know, it's very, very important to be able to take the right decision in a particular situation. So as I said, even if one thing is we have to work on ourselves to gain all of these, to be able to become more dharmic, the other way is when we are in a situation, if we have the luxury of time, can we sleep over that decision? Can we think over it? Can we spend more time? Can we calm ourselves? Can we calm our emotions and get ourselves under control and then make that decision? If we have that luxury, I think we should do that, right? So that is why these three are very, very important qualities when we're talking about taking right decisions. Tama, Indriya Nigraha, and Akrodha. The next two are Dhi and Vidya. Dhi is discrimination. That is the root for the word buddhi too. Vidya is knowledge. It's very important to gather as much information, knowledge and understanding as possibly can about the situation before we take a decision in that particular decision, in that particular situation. And then we use the intellect or the buddhi to decide exactly what is the right thing to do. So to make that effort to know all the perspectives of that particular problem is always very important. And sometimes we fail to do that. We only look at it from our perspective, especially when we want to change traditions, when we want to change the way in which we work. This applies to everything. You know, all of us in the organizations we work, we're always looking at bringing in some change, which is not wrong. In fact, change is something which we always have to look forward to and try to bring in. But when we are doing that, it's very important to gather as much knowledge about why rules are already there in place. What is the reasoning behind a particular rule being there before we make attempts to change it, right? So that first, it is important to first understand the rules and regulations before we try to discriminate about it. That's why Dhi and Vidya, a person should make the effort to know before he or she goes about trying to amend the rules which are already there. And lastly, and most importantly, the quality of Asteya. Asteya means non-stealing, or not having an eye on any kind of benefit, monetary or otherwise, that does not naturally belong to one, right? See, sometimes when we do the right action, we may benefit in the end. I gave the example of Arjuna, right? Arjuna was supposed to do a dharmic act, and when he does that dharmic act, he's going to win the war and he's going to gain the kingdom, right? So he's going to benefit in that. So sometimes when we are doing the right action, we may benefit from it, right? If we are benefiting rightfully, that does not make our decision selfish, right? We still are doing what is the most dharmic thing to be done. Or the corollary of that is, by simply giving away our benefit, it does not mean that we are always making the choice which is dharmic. But the idea is we should never have an eye on anything that does not rightfully belong to us. A classic example of that is, you know, typically what our politicians do when they give away freebies just before an election. You know, we see that so often in India and I think many other countries. When they do that, the poor benefit, right? The politicians are giving. You think of that as an act of, magnanimity. But what they are doing is they are giving away what is not theirs. And in the process, they're trying to earn the goodwill or popularity, which is actually not their due. They're doing an act. That act looks selfless. That act looks something like an act that is going to benefit a larger number of people. But they're doing it with the eye on gaining something which is not actually rightfully theirs. So that itself becomes an act of stealing. So even when we are in a situation when we are looking at making a decision and we are saying that, you know, this is a decision, I'm doing this out of compassion, I'm doing this out of goodness, I'm doing this out of kindness. But if we have an eye on earning the goodwill of people through that, or, you know, I will become popular if I make this decision, or I will win the love of people when I do this, I think if we are taking any decision with a gain that is not natural in that process to us, I think that is what is referred to as asteya. And that is what these 10 qualities, I think, so very beautifully describes how, as I said, it is not just about selflessness or selfishness. To be able to make the right decision, that's what the Manusmriti says, only a person who has all of these qualities perfectly in him will be taking the right decision at all times. So even as we work on ourselves spiritually to gain control over ourselves, to gain control over our emotions, to become more selfless, to become more pure in our thoughts, to become more compassionate and loving, automatically we are actually graduating towards a person who is likely to make the right decision at any given situation. And coming to that point of, you know, when you don't have the time to make the right decision, when your decision has to be spontaneous, yes, when we take the right decision, going through all of these processes, thinking as much as we can and taking as much time as we can, we have the luxury to take, and making a conscious decision when we have the time, eventually when that situation comes where we don't have the luxury of time, when you have to take spontaneous decisions, Swami says that you're more likely to take the more dharmic decision in such situations when you have practiced in leisure, right? That's what I always give the example of it, any sport for that matter, any athlete. An athlete who needs to perform in Olympic game or in a situation where there's a lot of tension and pressure on that athlete, that performance is possible only when the practice has been done in leisure, when nobody else is watching, there's no pressure on you, and you know you're all by yourself, you practice, right? So we will not be able to make that decision spontaneously if we have not done that when we were in leisure. And if we are in a crisis situation, if we have to make a decision, I think some of these points are useful, right? You try to gather as much information as possibly can about that situation. And selflessness, of course, is an important quality. See if you're acting under the influence of any of your emotions, be it your sensual cravings or your anger or your bias or anything like that. If it is, try to calm yourself, try to insulate your mind from those things. And finally, make the right decision. If there can be any amount of forgiveness in the process that can benefit the entire situation, give forgiveness the first option. And I think the other points that I made can be used. So as always, I'm not giving a direct answer to the question of, is it right to let them benefit or not benefit? But I hope you'll be able to make a better decision, because I think you are in a better position to see what are the other details involved in this particular decision, and I'm sure you'll be able to make a more informed decision. And what I said is applicable to generally all the situations that we tend to face, especially if we are in a situation where we can influence the rule making or influence the changing of rules and regulations. I think it's very important to follow some of these things. I thank Sister Vijaya for asking this question. I know there are two more questions. Probably for the next episode, we'll take the other two questions. But I thought this was very important to go into as much detail. I hope it's all right. With that, dear listeners, it's time for me to wrap up this week's show. Radio Sai answering booth. If you have a question on practical spirituality which you would like me to answer on this show, feel free to write to me. My mail ID is prem@radiosai.org. That's prem@radiosai.org. That's my personal mail ID. So if you wish to be anonymous, you can tell me. Nobody else reads your mails. And I can not mention your name too if that's what you want. And if you can record your question in your own voice like Sister Vijaya did today, it would be wonderful. It's always nice to have another fresh voice on the show. If you have anything to ask based on the answer that I gave today, feel free to write to me. I would be glad to explain on air or off air, as the case may be. I most humbly offer this effort at Swami's lotus feet. I'm going to leave you with a song, a very beautiful song, which was sung in Swami's presence. On the other side of it, you'll have the last segment of today's Thursday Live, the Vahini Satsang. But I'll join you all again next week for the next episode of Radio Sai Answering Booth.
Sai Ram.